Hello, welcome back to the Fitcast. This is episode number 360. My name is Kevin Larrabee, and back on the show, I don't know how many times, probably a baker's dozen at this point, is the wonderfully talented author of not only Men's Health, the New Rules of Lifting series, someone that I met at, I think, my very first fitness seminar. Yeah, that's about right. And now back to talk about his latest book that he co-wrote with Alan Cosgrove, Strong. Lou, how you doing?
Good, Kevin. So, yeah, so neither of us knows how many times I've been on. My guess is like 352.
Right. I think it's like it's not like an every other thing. It's like two on, one off.
Yeah, right.
But
yeah,
there's a reason for it, though. It's because, you know, you're out there, you're putting together these books like the New Rules of Lifting series. Way back, one of the first books, and not to go too far back, I think I've hit on this before, but one of the first books that I ever read, or it might have been the first book, was The Testosterone Advantage Plan.
Wow. That is going – and actually, I was just thinking about that today. Yeah, that's a long time ago. 2002, January 2002.
So that was the book that got me off of eating like nothing but like rice cakes and like that was my diet food at the time, and then got me eating like actual food that would help me with my results in the weight room at I guess I was 16 or 17 years old at the time when I picked that thing up, and that was the first book. Jeez. But now it's 2015 and you got another new book.
Yeah, just, you know, wait long enough, 12 months, 18 months, there's always another one because, you know, what else am I going to do? I mean, typing is like my only skill, so I have to keep going.
Well, you always have like the next book in mind. I have to guess. That's got to be a pretty – is it like a daunting task for you, or just as a writer, you're just like, yeah, like this is the next book and I kind of know – you know, how I'm going to lay it out and stuff like that. Now I just need to, you know, put my fingers to the keys and I just got to spend the time typing it all out now.
No, everything's a daunting task. It's you know, every article I write, every book I write, I have the, you know, I have the, you know, not too far in the rearview mirror is, you know, I'll write an article and at some point, I'm going to touch on a subject I've already written about 27 times. So I've got to find the 28th way to write about that so it doesn't sound stale. Mm. And, you know, with all these books I write, I never cut and paste anything from one book to another. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'll cut and paste like, a couple of basic descriptive sentences within the same book. But from one book to another, I will always sit down and try to find a different way to say something, even if we're talking about like the most basic exercise description. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I just end up retyping almost word for word what I wrote somewhere else. But it's just it's sort of like the self-imposed discipline of it. I at least make myself retype it so that I at least thought, is there a better way to say this? Is there a better way to describe this exercise? Mm-hmm. I also have, you know, the history of, you know, more than a decade now of people complaining about, you know, something that they didn't understand or something that they thought was either too wordy or not wordy enough. I mean, you're never going to please everybody, but a lot of smart people read these books and read multiple books. So when they tell me that something's off, you know, I have to take that seriously. And a lot of times it helps me figure out how to do the next one better.
Well, we're definitely going to get into, I don't know if you'd necessarily call them like lessons that you've learned from book to book, but after you write all these books, you get so much feedback, whether it be a review on Amazon, an email, on Facebook, on Twitter now, like there is an infinite amount of ways for people to tell you if they hate your book, if they love your book, if they, you know, don't understand something and they need follow up. So we'll definitely hit on that.
But you know, before we jump off what you just said, I got to say that you just mentioned how many ways there are to get in touch with me or to get my attention. Mm-hmm. And every now and then somebody will say, hey, what's your email address? And I got to say that, you know, when you work for a magazine, if somebody ever asks that question, you automatically know they can't write for the magazine because they have no reporting skills at all. I mean, I can't imagine anything easier than finding when somebody is a public, you know, as a quasi public figure, if you can't figure out how to get in touch with that person, in fact, you're already in touch with that person. If you can't figure out how to find something like their email, I got to say, you know, you really have no business in, you know, in that same business, because, you know, there are certain baseline standards of initiative that you have to reach.
Well, I mean, it's literally in the, like, I'm looking at the jacket, which is the fancy way of saying like the book cover, but I just know that word. You know, it says LouSchuler.com, and then you go to LouSchuler.com, the email's on the front page.
Right, on the front page, yeah.
Jeez, that's some scary stuff. You know, as we get towards election season, you know, it's always important to think about our future and what direction we want to go down. So ask those candidates if they know how to get hold of LouSchuler. If you see them at a town hall meeting, yeah, that's the important question. It's like you watch these debates on CNN and whatever. I guess there's going to be one coming up on like MSNBC. It's always about the important questions, not just like, what do you think about Iraq? It's okay. So we're not going to talk about that, though. We're going to talk about the book Strong, and it is titled Strong. Transform yourself into the badass you were meant to be. And I have to ask, like, this is probably a question that you've already got a couple times, but, you know, this is a book that is being marketed towards women. The beautiful Jesse Neeland is on the front cover, looking like a badass. And, you know, this is a book that's written by two men to be directed towards women. I have to guess, like, there are going to be some women that, you know, may look at this book and be like, well, LouSchuler doesn't know what it's like to, you know, to walk in my shoes or to deal with the, you know, different bodily functions a woman might have or the stressors in life, things that they need to deal with in the gym, so on and so forth. So I don't know, like, what do you have to, you know, what do you say to someone like that who gives you that question?
Well, first off, I agree 100%. I mean, I have no idea how it feels physically to be a woman. I certainly am not, you know, I work on my empathy, but it hasn't gone that far that I understand what it feels like to be a woman, to walk into a weight room, to have a completely different ratio of upper body and lower body strength, to have a completely different body composition issues, to have the, you know, chemical maelstrom hit, you know, every 28 days. Mm. However, if we want to talk about why a couple of guys are writing a workout book for women, we got to go all the way back to the very beginning. Mm-hmm. And I just got to know before I launch into that story, if you're ready for that.
No, I got my seatbelts on. I'm ready to go.
Okay. All right. So now it's October 2004.
Okay.
All right. October 2004. And I'm in Columbus, Ohio. And I'm sitting across a desk from Dave Tate at his warehouse. I am interviewing him for an article I'm writing on powerlifting for Men's Journal. Mm-hmm. And Jim Wendler's walking around. He worked for Dave back then, so he's walking around. So I'm sitting there in this warehouse with these two massive guys, and I'm, you know, asking, you know, picking Dave's brain. And of course, Dave's an incredibly busy guy, so for him to be giving me time is just wonderful.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I get a call on my rudimentary little cell phone, and I said, "Oh, Dave, I'm sorry, it's my agent. I got to take this." So he's calling from New York. So duck out real quick, and he says, "Look, this editor at Penguin is really interested in new rules of lifting." David, my agent, had just sent out the proposal a couple weeks before, and we're getting, you know, there are already some interest in it. And this one editor wanted to talk to me before she bid on the book. Mm-hmm. So it was late in the afternoon. I had to walk back in and say to Dave, who I had asked to spend time with me for this interview, for this article. I said, "Dave, man, I'm really sorry, but I got to go." He's looking at me like, you know, he never said it. And he's always been really nice to me, you know, since then. But I always wondered what exactly he was thinking. It's like, do you understand? I'm Dave Tate and you're not, and you're interviewing me and now you're running out the door.
Well, at least I feel like, not to jump in, but at least I feel better. When I interviewed him for the show, like, this was like episode 40 or 35. So this is super early in doing the show. I literally was like crapping my pants the whole time. Like I was stuttering. I was, because he's an intimidating dude. And like you said, you don't want to be wasting the guy's time whatsoever.
Yeah.
But you know, to his credit, great gentleman, does an amazing amount of work for charity.
Right.
Great, great guy, and very patient with a 19-year-old on the other end of a Skype call. So thank you.
Yeah, and absolutely. And, you know, like I said, he's never been like, you know, since then there's never been any, you know, he's always answered emails and stuff like that. But, you know, that was just a very weird moment. So I run back to my hotel room, call the and the reason I had to go back to my hotel to do this was because those rudimentary cell phones, you know, I had no idea if I would actually be able to reach this editor and, you know, and if the call would actually, you know, we could actually have a conversation before the signal cut out. So run back to my hotel room, call her. It was Megan Newman, who's at Penguin, still at Penguin, still, you know, publisher of all our books. Mm-hmm. We had this incredible first conversation, and I knew right then that this was the editor I wanted to work with on this series because she totally got what we were trying to do. Now, the important thing is this is the original New Rules of Lifting, which everyone perceived as a book for guys. And here's this female editor who was into pretty heavy lifting. You know, the entire publishing industry is in, you know, the lower Manhattan. And so she was like working out in these dungeon gyms down there, where, you know, where it's like all these gay guys. And you know, she's a pretty small woman and she's in there lifting with these guys. She's totally on board with the message of the book. Mm-hmm. You know, she ended up bidding for the book, won the bidding. We published it with her, came out January 2006. And immediately I began to get these questions. First, it was from I guess it was mainly female radio hosts. I'd get on their shows to promote the book, and they'd be like, "So why'd you write a book for guys? Why not for women?" And I would always say the same thing, which is, "Well, there's no reason a woman can't do these workouts, but you know, let's face it, you know, this is the kind of thing that guys are going to be more interested in." And then I began to hear it from readers: "Why did you write this book for guys and not for women?" So then I did what was probably the easiest decision of my entire career. I went back to Megan, my editor, and I said, "Hey, how about if we write a book for women?" And she's like, "Great." So that was really easy. So the original title of the book, we were not going to make it. It wasn't going to be like New Rules branded. It was The title was Lift Like a Man, Look Like a Goddess.
And right. I remember you talking to me about that a while back.
Well, right. So I've already told that story in FitCast, so I won't go into all that. We eventually ended up calling it New Rules of Lifting for Women, which was, you know, again, one of those, like one of the easiest decisions ever. And that book came out in 2008. It did well. When it came out in paper, when both books came out in paperback a year later, they did phenomenally well. And that set the stage for the whole rest of the series. Mm-hmm. So now we get to, why are two guys writing books for women? And it comes back to the premise of the original book, Lift Like a Man, was, okay, women are going to gyms. And my original target was young, healthy women who were willing to work hard, but seemed to do really suboptimal things in the weight room. You know, that in one of the stories I tell in the original New Rules of Lifting for Women is watching this woman in my gym who is obviously fit and healthy and lean and, you know, somewhere in her mid-20s. And I saw her lean over a bench, do a set of tricep kickbacks with like 5-pound dumbbells, and then put those down and do one arm bent over rows with like 6 pounds or 8 pounds. I've got the number in the book. I forget what the actual number was. And I looked at that and I thought, how could that be? How could anybody train like that? And what I concluded when I was looking, you know, I went through the bookstores, got all the books that I could find that seemed to be, you know, geared toward women, and looked at women's magazines, and I realized, well, they're getting this from their own media, because their own media are treating them like, you know, these fragile creatures that will fall apart if they lift any weight that's not, you know, either plastic coated or chrome plated, mm-hmm. you know, 10 pounds. You know, women's magazines, you never saw a woman using a barbell. And if she was using a barbell, it was never an Olympic barbell. It was like one of those, you know, one of those small ones with the chrome plates on the end. And not only that, it would be like some 6 foot tall, 120 pound fashion model with like these legs that were, you know, that went up to her armpits. And she'd be doing like Romanian deadlifts with 20 pounds and a mixed grip, you know, yeah. and barely lowering the bar to her knees. And that was what training advice for women looked like when we started writing that book in 2006. That was typical. That was the better magazines like Shape. Right, and I think Fitness was pretty good back then. So the reason I get into all this was, so the premise of the book is, the conceit is, look, if women won't tell you how to do this stuff and do it so it's effective and do it so you actually get stronger and that you build muscle and that muscle is good and strength is good, if women won't tell you that, okay, then here's a couple guys who will tell you that. And of course, one of, you know, I say that, but one of our co-authors was Cassandra Forsythe, very much a woman, also very strong, serious lifter, mm-hmm. et cetera. So that was the premise all the way up until we changed the title to New Rules of Lifting for Women. And then the man-woman thing kind of came into play because now we hadn't emphasized quite as much that these were guys talking to women. And I've gotten a little bit of feedback, but most of the feedback has come just in the last couple of years where people will review it on Amazon like it's a brand new book. Mm-hmm. So if this isn't going on too long, can I tell you one more story?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, so this happened, I think it was 2 years ago. And I've always kicked myself for not having like a paper trail, an exact record of what happened. But my memory is pretty good. Looked there on the saw that there was a new review of New Rules of Lifting for Women on Amazon. And I looked at it and it was the most scathing review you could imagine. This woman was, you know, I can't believe this guy, you know, this is mansplaining at its finest and just ripping into me for, you know, for daring to be a guy who would write to women. Now, the woman posted this anonymously, but on Amazon, anonymous is not always anonymous.
Right.
So it took me like 10 seconds to figure out who she was.
It's like you take that username, then you just search, you find them on a forum or something like that.
Well, no, in her case, it was she had a wish list. So I just clicked on her wish list, and that was her real name. So,
whoops.
So I had her real name. I Googled her, and I figured out she was somebody like me, you know, pretty well educated, I forget what, but she was in the business world. But she was sort of like where I am. She was writing a lot. She was, you know, doing public speaking. And so found her email address, emailed her, and said, look, you know, and I should say that authors should never respond to readers who write negative reviews. But in this one case, it was so cripplingly unfair that it's like I will hate myself if I don't respond to this. Mm-hmm. So I said, look, you have every right. Since you purchased the book, you have every right to say whatever the hell you want. But let me explain a few things. Starting with, we wrote this book in 2006 and 2007. It came out in 2008. And then I told her the word mansplaining was not even coined until, you know, and I told her what the exact reference was. And then I said, you said that we had like no references, that we were just making like these claims and nothing to back them up. But there's an entire chapter of notes in the back. And I understand that if you bought the Kindle edition, it's not obvious that the notes are back there and you may not have even seen them. But to say that they're not there at all is really unfair to me. And it's obviously inaccurate. So I sent her this email. She never responded to it. But within an hour, that review was down. Mm. So I was like, shit, the review is down and I have no record of it. All I have, I didn't cut and paste, you know, I didn't make a copy of it. So now I have no record that this review ever existed. But a couple days later, another review popped up under a different name, real person, not the person I had talked to, with a whole lot of the same thoughts and just the inaccuracies taken out. So that review still exists, and I'm convinced that, you know, whoever went after me the first time still wanted to get me, but just didn't want to be out there, you know, with an inaccurate review. But they still went after me, and for a lot of the same reasons. You know, how can a guy talk to women? Now, the actual people who use the program, I've never talked to anybody who did Alan's entire program. Especially people who have read, gone on to read the other New Rules books or who have corresponded with me in any way, I've never heard from any of them that there's a problem with a guy writing for women. Mm-hmm. And I think that if we've done anything in our series that maybe changed the paradigm a little bit or help change the paradigm. It's this idea that men and women shouldn't really train in these dramatically different ways that were promoted for like virtually the entire time I wrote about fitness up until the point where these books started to get popular. Mm-hmm. And that's about the exact same time around 2009 that you started to see a lot of female fitness pros starting up blogs, writing articles, promoting heavy training for women. Mm-hmm. This whole thing, this idea that, you know, yeah, we look different, we're built differently, but muscle fibers are muscle fibers, strength is strength, muscle is muscle. This whole idea, as that began to catch on, I think we're hearing this less and less, that, you know, why are two guys writing for women? When the fact is, well, information's information, right? If muscles are muscles and strength is strength, information's information, and it's either good information or it's not. And if you think it's good information, you buy the book, you do the program, what difference does it make what gender I am?
And I think you even brought this up in the book, but it's a lot of, I mean, with these books and, you know, with other books out there that have good content, you're trying to really undo the last 20 years of women's fitness books that have come out. And even they're still coming out. Like you look on Amazon, there's still garbage coming out, but you're trying to have to clean it up and be like, and you guys, and like, I read this book the other night and, you know, just kind of going through it, I ended up highlighting a crap ton of it. And, I ended up talking, to Mike Boyle about it just because there's a lot of like concepts in here. I'm like, oh man, like this is the way like Lou words this stuff. Like this is like perfect for the way that we, you know, talk about this stuff at our gym for the women that come in. But you bring up a lot of those concepts that were brought up in the past to scare women or that are not backed by research or just bullshit. And then having to be like, nope, look at, here's the research. This is why that's not true. This is why you should be doing it, you know, the way that that's why we built the programs like we do in this book and stuff like that. So, seriously, hats off like this. I mean, I know you, Lou, so I might be blowing a little smoke. But I've read all of these books. Like, I think this is better than all the New Rules of Lifting books. I think this is the best book that you guys, have done. And, before we get into it, like, I just got to say, I'll talk with, next episode you have here from Alan Cosgrove, but those programs that he put together are badass. Those are awesome programs. I don't care if you're a man or a woman. If you're listening to this right now, if you're like a man or a woman and you want a great fitness book, you should get this book. I know it's marketed towards women, but the information in here is outstanding for men too. And I think,
well, can I thank you very much for what you just said. I really appreciate it. And I take that as very high praise because, you know, to say that, you know, it surpasses anything I've done is really, you know, I mean, that's incredibly flattering for me to hear that. So I appreciate that. I did these workouts and these are really hard workouts.
Yeah.
And there were some, a group of women, who have a New Rules group on Facebook. I gave, earliest copies, to a couple of them. And they were saying, hey, you know, this shit is really hard. And the reason it's really hard is that somebody who's completely entry level, who had never picked up a weight before, could go into the gym and they could do these workouts. Mm-hmm. And it might be awkward at first to learn some of these exercises, but they can do it. They can stumble through it, and an hour of this is not going to crush them. But if you've got somebody who's intermediate to advanced and they're doing these workouts, these workouts may very well crush them, because when you're working with in these intermediate rep ranges, especially in these early workouts, you're used to pushing yourself pretty hard. Mm-hmm. And as you start pushing yourself in these workouts, you get into a really serious state of fatigue, because as a more advanced lifter, you're recruiting a lot more muscle units. There's going to be a lot more fatigue building up. It's going to be a lot harder than it looks on paper. And in fact, it's going to be a lot harder for you than it is for the beginner who's never trained before. Mm-hmm. Because they don't have the, you know, they aren't able to coordinate the motor units the way that the more advanced lifter is able to do. So these workouts, even though they're the same on paper, they may as well be two really different programs. They're this really good, comprehensive starter program for the beginner, a really good training program, say, for somebody in the middle, and then for somebody who's been training for a while. These may be actually so hard that you'll have to modify them. Mm-hmm. Because if you really push yourself set after set, you may get, 40 minutes in and go, holy shit, I still got 20 minutes more to go.
Right.
It's tough.
Yeah, and even the warm-ups are really impressive too. And just because as like a, as someone that does this stuff every day, seeing just like the great – and it's like the way that Alan kind of like puts it forward in terms of like the warm-ups and stuff like that is like it's like a template. It's like you plug and play and you get to put in the movements that you want. But he's like, these are the movements that you got to make sure that you're doing, which is just – outstanding. It's like, again, for $20 with all these books, like you kind of get just an incredible amount of value. And I don't get a penny from selling any of these books. I'm just saying that again right now. But just pulling up the warm up page. It's on page 114 for people that have their books and they want to follow along at home. But just everything, the way that he structures it and just he gives you options for doing stuff. You have your progressions or regressions in there, but you're still going to be doing, this amount of reps for each one of them and just a badass warm up. But seriously, I think if you're a man or a woman, like a lot of the stuff that you talk about in here, whether it be the programming, whether it be the psychological aspects of stuff, the things that we've been told in the past, the science behind this stuff, the research, what it's telling us now, that is probably my biggest piece of feedback. Is like, I'm just like almost kind of bummed that it's being directed at women because there's so many men out there that could benefit from this information too.
Well, sure. And now, I think we're sort of 180 degrees from where we were when we came out with the first book, because when we came out with the first book, we were saying, well, there's nothing in here women can't use. We just didn't assume they'd be interested. Mm-hmm. And now with this book, like you just said, the information in there is all actionable for any healthy adult for either gender. I guess there's many more than two now, but for any gender anywhere on the spectrum. Mm-hmm. And the question is, will guys want to do it? I mean, that, obviously a guy's going to look at that picture of Jesse on the cover and certainly be interested, at least in looking at the cover. Whether they'll want to open it up and, start reading on page one is a whole different question. I'll be really flattered if they do. I won't be surprised if they don't. But, what I am satisfied with is that Alan created another great program, a lot of elements that haven't been seen before in the series. And people who do these workouts, no matter, why they do them, who's doing them, I think they're going to get something out of this.
Well, let's go. And this is as we start recording this live, actually, people jumped in and started asking a lot of questions on Facebook. So we'll get to that, too. A couple of things that I wanted to hit on in the book, though, again, the way that it's structured, you're getting like a great introduction just on like the mindset of this stuff. Also a great section on nutrition too. And the thing that was kind of being hammered home to me while I was reading this is like, we just keep forgetting to master the basics, to really make sure that we are covering, people call it, I think it was way back in the day, John Fast used the word big rocks. Like you got to make sure we take care of the big rocks and not get so caught up in the minutia of all this stuff. And, again, just the kind of points that you guys are hammering home when it comes to the nutrition for people too, which tends to be where people get tripped up. They just get so many different things in their ear on how they should be eating, when they should be eating, what they should be eating. How did you guys approach the nutrition section?
Well, that was just me. I mean, as much pressure, and as much demand as I put on Alan on the training program and all the questions I have to ask him as I'm writing that up. I don't bother him with the nutrition stuff. I show it to him, and if he has comments on it, he can make comments. Mm-hmm. you know, that on the nutrition side, I sort of, you know, I did my time as an ideologue. And back then, you know, you mentioned testosterone advantage plan. Back then, you know, I felt like such an absolutist, you know, that it had to be certain amount of protein, certain amount of carbohydrates, you know, certain amount of fat, that if you didn't do it like more or less that way, it was going to be much harder. Or if you, you know, were like really low fat, high carbs, that would never work. And I've really gotten off the idea that any of this stuff is absolute. I just remember back to when I was first starting out in 1992. I was a part-time copy editor at Muscle and Fitness magazine, or I guess that's even going back to like December 1991, part-time copy editor at Muscle and Fitness magazine. And back then everything was low fat, low fat, low fat, and carbs, 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 you know, plain white rice. And those guys were ripped back then. People are ripped now. To say that only one thing works because it's what people are doing now to get ripped, mm-hmm, is absolutely as absurd as back in the 90s saying this low-fat stuff is the only thing that works because that's what people are doing now to get ripped. Mm-hmm. People have been able to get in fantastic shape using a lot of different methods over a long period of time. You know, certainly go back to these, you know, late 19th century, early 20th century guys like Eugene Sandow, and you look at them and you go, well, you know, they didn't, what did they have that we don't have? Mm-hmm. How did that guy end up being, you know, basically hitting whatever you think 100% of his genetic potential would be and being strong as hell despite being a fairly small guy? Well, how did that happen? What magical training secrets did he have? And I think that, you know, the answer is, well, nobody really has any magical training secrets. They just have what works for everybody and then what works specifically for that individual. And if we try to make it out to be any more than that, that we have some piece of magic, that we have some secret that nobody else has ever uncovered, then I think we're lying. And we may be doing that deliberately to make money. And I guess, you know, well, that's, you know, basically advertising exists to get people to make bad choices, right?
Right.
Otherwise, why would you have to advertise your product? So I sort of understand why that's out there, but I think that as you started off saying, it does unnecessarily confuse people to think that, well, I have to precisely time my meals. I have to, you know, I can only combine these nutrients with those nutrients. And if I combine any other nutrients, I'm going to get fat. And if I do cardio here instead of here, I'm going to get fat. And if I do, you know, eat this kind of food, I'll get fat. And the answer is, you know, I mean, we come back to the basics. Well, why do you get fat? It's because you're eating too much food for your activity level. Mm-hmm. And let's go from there. let's start with that one. If you need to, if the goal is, you know, if you have a body composition goal, want to lose weight, then let's start with the basics. Let's figure out the most painless way for you to eat less and still have enough food to where you feel good and to where you still train hard. And I got to say, that's the one thing Alan has always emphasized, I think, throughout the entire history of the series, is if you want the results of this program, you've got to be able to eat enough food, mm-hmm, so that you can work out hard. And if you're cutting your calories to the point where you can't do these hard workouts, the program is simply not going to work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, go try to do the Velocity Diet, see how you feel when you go train. And this is like this kind of like two directions I can go with this, but you have a section that you start off with talking about like old science and some of the stuff you're just bringing up, like, you know, or even conventional wisdom of, you know, breakfast is always the most important meal of the day. The whole thing that we heard, I guess it was about 10 years ago, it was like the six meals, like that was, we were supposed to eat every 2 to 3 hours, keep that fire stoked. I did not know this. This is something that I just learned from this book, but that, you know, the concept that, you know, a pound of body fat is 3,500 calories, and that's what we need to, that 3,500 calorie number is the number that we need to target to lose 1 pound of body fat. But you explain, like, and again, you use some of the latest research. You even referenced that you used research from the last 2 to 3 years for this book, or much of the research in the book is from the last 2 to 3 years. It may take 4,300 calories to lose that pound for some people. It might take less. Leaner people lose weight faster than those with a higher body fat percentage, and men lose fat faster than women. And it is not like an exact science when it comes to this stuff. Women are a little bit of a disadvantage, and people that aren't as lean are at a bigger disadvantage.
Yeah, and I, you know, you hate to say that the lesson is, well, it's best to never gain the weight in the first place, because it's, you know, you can't say that to somebody, because you have to speak to people where they are right now, not where they were 10 years ago, or where you wish they were if they hadn't made, you know, some of the choices they made or hadn't had some of the hardships they had. I mean, obviously, all those things are, you know, not even any point talking about that. We got to talk about where people are now. And I figure may as well tell the truth that even though if you just look at a pound of fat in isolation, yeah, there's 3,500 calories worth of energy within that pound of fat. But as you said, the energy deficit required to make that pound of fat go away, to metabolize that pound of fat, is going to be different for different people. Lean people will have that advantage, and overweight people will have, it will be more of a struggle. Now, you know, the person who say is overweight and new to exercise also may have some advantages in that virtually anything is going to work. Mm-hmm. Any sort of exercise program combined with a mild calorie deficit is probably going to, you know, that person's going to get that magical result of building strength and muscle tissue while losing fat. I don't know how long that'll last, but basically there's results out there for everybody. It's just not going to be evenly distributed.
The thing that you were mentioning that I was alluding to before, just in, like, in terms of all the garbage out there, is a good point to bring up now, is and you put this very, very well, beware the rabbit holes of the internet, especially when you do have something. If you are on Twitter, if you are on Facebook, and all it does is, you know, all it takes is someone to copy paste a link on there, and you have a bunch of new information that you don't know if you can trust it or not.
Right.
It may say that you're, like, it may contradict what you're doing right now, and then you start thinking like you're wasting your time. So what advice do you have for people that are, you know, they listen to the show, but sometimes they might see an article that pops up? How do you kind of weed out what is BS or not?
Boy, that is so hard to do, because now we're in a moment where there's so much health and fitness and nutrition journalism out there that pretty much anything that anybody once believed has been debunked. You can find a place, you know, you can find a place where it's debunked. For example, something that I'm pretty sure I put into this book was I talked about how this idea that the ideal body weight is ideal for everybody is flawed. And the evidence being that heavier people actually statistically have a lower risk of mortality in any given year than people who are, you know, at this, what we call the normal weight or below. Mm-hmm. And I just read an article today where some researchers were going after that and saying, well, that's not really true, because all we, you know, you're using weight as one time point. So we don't know if somebody used to be 20 pounds heavier and then they lost 20 pounds. So they look like their normal weight, but actually they haven't been that weight all their lives. That's just the weight they are this year. Mm. And so we're looking at them and we're measuring that. But, you know, reading this article, I'm like, you know, so they're saying, so the obesity paradox, it doesn't really exist. Everybody should be one weight. Everybody should be this weight. But what happens if you're not that weight? You know, what do we tell people who are 20 pounds over that weight? Do we say, well, if you lose weight to get down to what we consider to be a normal, healthy weight, which, of course, I still believe is an arbitrary standard, but that, you know, move on from there. Mm-hmm. Do we say, well, no, don't lose weight because it's unhealthy to lose weight, but don't stay at this weight because it's unhealthy to be at this weight? So basically the only people who we consider to be healthy and normal weight are people who do not struggle with their weight, are people who somehow are resistant to this obesogenic, food-rich environment that we now have for the first time in human history. what do we tell people? I mean, do we hector on people and say, well, you know, everything is bullshit. Nothing works. Basically, the only way to live longer is to be born lucky and never struggle with your weight and find exercise easy and not have a long history of injuries. And who does that help? Doesn't help anybody.
Man, let's just give up.
Right. So I think that, you know, what we can do in a program like this is we can, as I said earlier, talk to people exactly where they are now. If they want to lose weight, well, we can help with that. If they don't want to lose weight, well, then we can help them get in better shape at the weight they are right now. And I have certainly been shocked over the years when we put out a book and we don't think it's a weight loss program and people come to me and say, yeah, I lost 80 pounds. I lost 50 pounds. Man, I can't believe this. I've lost, you know, 20 pounds just in, you know, stage one of your program. And I'll hear this and I'm not going to call them a liar or anything, but I just think, holy shit, how did you do that? Because there's nothing in this program that should, you know, that we certainly don't make that promise. And there's nothing in this program that should produce that result. But it goes to show that there's so much variety out there and people have such different experiences that if somebody gives a program a shot, you just never know how well it's going to work.
There's another quote that, if you don't mind, I'm going to just read real quick that, for the fitness professionals that are listening out there, I know there's quite a few of you. You had a great section just on the fitness professionals that are just really in shape for that photo shoot. Like they get ready for that photo shoot. They're ripped. They're like, you know, the guys are at like 6% body fat. They're just jacked. And I just really like this quote. You only show skin when you're sure you'll win. You're only going to post those pictures on Facebook when you know you're going to get the likes. You're going to get the, oh man, yeah, that looks awesome. Or you're going to have those pictures ready for your bio on your website or for your article and stuff like that. I don't know. I don't know why I wanted to bring that up, but it maybe it's just because like I've never been one of those guys that's like 200 pounds and 6% body fat and is jacked. So I just thought that was interesting to
well, sure. And that's a comment that I remember a couple of years ago.
No, sorry. It was the woman that posted a picture of herself that after she got in much better shape, she was in great shape and she had just had four kids, but you said, but it violated an unwritten rule of the fitness industry. You only show skin when you sure you're win.
Right. Yeah. That was from, was talking about Janine Trimbley.
Correct.
Yeah. You know, who had had four kids and, you know, had some loose skin over the, you know, over the middle, which, you know, happens when you after four pregnancies. But one comment that I started getting when the fitness summit got really big a few years ago, and all of a sudden we went from like 40 people a year to 80 and then 100 and then 120 this year. So people would say, wow, all these fitness professionals don't look like the pictures on their website. And we started hearing that. But I don't know. To me, yeah, I understand why you need to be all ripped and shredded for your, you know, for your own self-promotional photos. But to me, the goal of training is to be comfortable in your own skin, to feel strong, to feel good, to feel fit, to feel healthy, to feel like you've got this, you know, this energy. You know, I think to me it's a huge win if you wake up in the morning and you think, hey, I get to work out today. And you're actually looking forward to that workout. You can't do you're never going to have that feeling if you're like in a chronic energy deficit with the goal of always looking good with your shirt off, even if there's no situation at all that would come up that day where you would have to take your shirt off. And if you did have to take your shirt off and there's a little flesh over there, who cares? You feel good. You look forward to your workout. You're healthy. To me, that's a win.
Yeah, I think maybe some of that is like an age thing too, because I know it. Like you and I talked a while back, and like that was something that kind of changed as I got to like my late 20s. Like I am comparative to the guy on the street in great shape. I'm strong, yep. But I'm also you know, not going to be on the cover of Men's Health next month, and that's okay. I think it's something that, you know, fitness professionals tend to get into. A bad habit of comparing themselves to the other fitness professionals' photos that were, like you mentioned, like may have just been when they were in the best shape they've ever been in, but they made sure they took a snapshot of that. So they have that for, sure, for the records.
And, you know, I've worked with countless models over the years and, you know, a couple of women, mainly guys. And, you know, models are just, they're genetically different from the rest of us.
Right.
These aren't guys who have to, you know, shed 20 pounds in 2 days when, you know, you don't have that much warning from one photo shoot to the next if you're a professional fitness model. So these are guys who, yeah, they work really hard at it, but they, you know, genetically, it's just they're better at staying very close to what would be peak shape for literally anyone else. It might not be their peak shape, mm-hmm, but it would certainly be a better shape than, for example, I could ever attain. But for them, it's just, you know, it's just their walking around body. This is what they have to do for their profession. A lot of those guys, when you spend time with them, they certainly train hard. You know, some of them, their diets aren't that strict. You know, they just, you know, they've got the genetics for that. And you can't look at, I mean, the whole reason that people are models is because of the way they reflect light. So the proportions, and in the case of fitness models, the body composition, that they look good from all these different angles. Mm-hmm. And that's something that, you know, you simply can't replicate with a training program. And it's something you shouldn't even aspire to, because these guys are such a tiny fraction, a 1% of the overall population. And even that is term limited. You know, the most fantastic fitness model in his mid-20s is not going to be the most fantastic fitness model in his mid-40s. You know, I mean, we're literally taking a snapshot of this person at one point, freezing it there. Mm-hmm. And we can't make any assumptions other than this guy was a great model and looked great at that moment.
Well, I always think about it this way, you know, and this is, again, this is just me thinking, but, you know, sometimes it is like you do what you're really good at. And, you know, you get kind of pulled in that direction. If you're tall, you probably are going to be playing basketball. Now, if you're fast, you're probably going to run track. If you have great body composition and, you know, it's easy for you to put on muscle mass, you might want to get into the fitness industry. Like it might make sense for you. That's an easier route to go. For me, it was like being the really fat kid that got into fitness and like thought, man, this would be a great way to force myself to stay in some reasonable shape for the rest of my life.
Right.
So yeah, it worked out.
Well, one thing that I've said, on more than one occasion, not sure if I put it into a book, is most people in the fitness industry look like fitness professionals before they got into the industry.
Right.
So there's a, we're talking about a sliver of the population that, as you just said, sort of became selected because of, you know, not just their interests and, you know, but their, you know, genetic proclivity to look like somebody, mm-hmm, who knows something about fitness, not judging, you know, anybody's knowledge or motivations or anything.
Or even like their work ethic. Like Michael, right, Jordan was great at basketball, but he still worked his ass off in the,
sure,
gym, you know, all day to right, make sure he was elite. You know, it's just like he had the right pool of genetics to,
sure,
put that hard work to effective use.
Yeah. And some guys with fantastic physiques are, well, I mean, look at the, you know, talk about an extreme outlier. Look at Dr. Spencer Nadolski. So here you've got somebody who obviously has fantastic genetics, obviously works hard, keeps himself in great shape, and the guy's a doctor. I mean, he not only has, you know, the great physique, which he's, you know, worked hard to build and maintain, but he has this incredible base of knowledge, and he's also super nice guy, works hard to help his patients and you know, to help other people. So there's nothing, it's not disparaging anybody to say, yeah, that guy had fantastic genetics, looked like a fitness pro before he became a fitness pro. That's just acknowledging that that's the reality of it. I mean, certainly, you know, one of the most depressing conversations I've had to have, and I had this constantly when I was at Men's Fitness and Men's Health magazines where I was hiring the models. The most depressing conversation is when you're just sitting across the table from somebody talking and they're like, yeah, so how do I get on the cover of Men's Health? How do I get into Men's Health? That's like my life goal. And I can just look at them and say, dude, you're great. You're smart. You're wonderful. You're in fantastic shape. You're not a fucking model. That's not going to happen because, you know, if nobody has told you to this point in your life, hey, you should be on the cover of Men's Health, then it's never going to happen because you simply don't look like somebody who should be on the cover. And that's all they're selecting is people who look like they should be on the cover of the magazine. They're not making any other judgment about that individual other than who's going to help us sell the most magazines. And one of the reasons I never had that conversation anymore is because they use all celebrities on these magazine covers now, so that doesn't even come up. Lucky for me.
You know, it's always good if you ever have a dark moment, you can always go into the mirror and say, I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and doggone it, people like me. That's always helped me from my therapist, Stuart Smiley.
assuming that last part is true, in your case it is, but, you know, a lot of people...
No, it depends on the day. It depends on the room. So let's go. And I promise you have a couple more minutes if we do some questions from Facebook real quick.
Sure. And I'll restrain myself from going off on these tangents.
No, this has been great. So first, you know, maybe a little bit of a jokey question, but since I'm on that path, Raj Law wants to know any tips for perfecting the bald head. Inquiring minds want to know.
Well, if you're in a cold weather climate, you definitely have to moisturize in the winter. Otherwise, everything gets off. Got to keep it short and moisturized.
Mm-hmm. Jeffrey Hemingway, friend over at Mark Fisher Fitness, great guy.
Did you say Mark Fisher Fitness?
I did.
Oh, I love Mark Fisher. Man, he's great. Yeah.
Oh, he is just amazing staff too, from top to bottom. Yeah. Just amazing group of people over there. Jeff wants to know some writing pet peeves. So many people have blogs and are putting out content. Any advice from an experienced writer on things to avoid?
You know, the main thing to avoid is writing to your weaknesses, because if nobody's paying you to write, write about something fun, write about something that you find absolutely fascinating and just tell it, put it in your own language. Don't try to write like anybody else. Don't try to write like you're writing an academic paper. Don't try to write like you're writing a magazine article, because believe me, people who write magazine articles for a living hate having to write articles that look like magazine articles. We would much rather write free form, the way we think a story should be told, rather than having to follow all the rules of that particular type of
word count.
Of service journal, not just the word count, but the way it's structured, you know, the references you can use, the topics you can address. You know, if nobody's paying you, man, just enjoy it.
This is from Kimberly Mills. Tips on getting published, or how to get published.
Well, I can't. here's something I actually told Kimberly one time. If you want sex tips, you don't go to a prostitute. And if you want writing tips, you don't go to you don't go to a professional writer, because, you know, let's face it, I don't want to say I'm cynical about what I do. I'm not, but I am pretty jaded. You know, I've been doing this for a long goddamn time, and it becomes like the question about. It's not like, can I be a model? Because anybody can learn to write. Mm-hmm. Basically, writing is just storytelling. It's just talking with your fingers, you know? If you can communicate with people, you can write. Like anything else, there's a craft to it. There's a, you know, you get better at it over time. But to go to somebody like me and say, how do I do it? It's like, just, man, well, just sit down and tell a story, write something interesting.
What do you think of, like, I know Amazon now, you know, not even talking about their pricing structure or whatever, but they do help people do self-publishing and stuff now. Have you looked at any of that stuff? Is that a viable option for people out there?
It is a viable option, but I got to say that when you put your stuff out there in the marketplace, you have to be prepared for the worst case scenario, which is being ignored entirely. And I know this because I put out a self-published novel, and I had worked on this particular novel for years. I've been writing fiction for well over, probably getting on close to 40 years by the time I put that there. Went to graduate school for creative writing. Saints Alive was, I would guess it was at least my sixth full-length novel, along with two sets of interlinked short stories, which are kind of novelistic when you put them all together. And that was at least the third draft of that book, which I've been working on in some form or another since probably 2005, when I first started coming up with those characters and writing chapters. So I finally put it out a couple of years ago, and friends bought it, family bought it, people said really nice things about it, and absolutely nobody else found this book, or if they, you know, if they did find it, they certainly didn't, you know, write reviews of it. I can, you know, look at the, you know, how many are sold, and it's like so few that I got to figure that everybody who bought it is like somebody who knows me from somewhere, mm-hmm. or is related to me. So if I can put something out there that is, you know, somebody who's sold well over a million books in my career, and I put a novel out there and can't get attention for it and can't get anybody interested in it, and, you know, believe me, somebody who has no reputation or, a smaller social media presence, you know, you just got to be prepared to be ignored. But if you want to put it out there, put it out there. I mean, Amazon's very helpful in that sense, because everything that they have on their site is profit for them. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, that's it's funny. I'm reading a book called it's from the author of Eat, Pray, Love. It's something called Creative Magic or Big Magic. Just on like I never really thought about it in terms of someone who's like an author. Like the thing that might be their biggest worry is like, A, this, what if this is not as good as the last thing that I put out? Or B, like you just said, what if, like, not even that people say that they hate it. What if just no one cares?
Right. Well, that's my experience. I'm not, you know, Elizabeth Gilbert is, you know, one of the most famous writers in the world right now, one of the most successful. And I'm certainly way, 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 way down the ladder from where she is, but I have the exact same worries every time I sit down to start a new project.
Fascinating book. It's making me, I have 43 pages of a time travel story that I've been working on for like 4 years. It's not good. All right. So,
but if you know what, it doesn't have to be good. If you like the story, just write the story.
Right. It's just, we won't get into this.
Okay. Sure.
Because I will talk about myself for a while, and I don't want to do this on the show where people want to hear about cool stuff. So, last question from Michael Hannaford, super fan of both my shows. Back My Play, I don't really do anymore. But what was your biggest personal motivation in choosing the topic of your new book?
My biggest personal motivation was knowing that this first, you know, the first book we wrote for women, New Rules of Lifting for Women, which is, I said like 15 hours ago when we started talking, was originally titled Lift Like a Man, Look Like a Goddess. Hearing the stories, meeting the readers of that book, hearing over and over again how important it was and how it not just changed their attitude toward workouts, but changed their attitude toward themselves. Hearing these stories over and over, and then in the next breath saying, what's next? Mm-hmm. I mean, when we sat down, Alan and I and Cassandra thought that we were writing a fitness book. I did not see it as a life transformation book. And yet for some people, that's exactly what it turned out to be. It turned out to be a completely different way of looking at themselves, seeing how they fit into the world, thinking about their bodies, thinking about what really matters. And I feel that even though we wrote three follow-up books, we kind of left the thread hanging there to where we haven't gone back and addressed that specific audience and said, you know, we wrote that book in 2006 and 2007, and in the subsequent seven, eight years, Alan has completely changed the way that he trains people. And yet, this is still our best-selling book. In any given week, New Rules of Lifting for Women sells about as well, at least as well, as the other four New Rules books combined.
Wow.
And, you know, there's it's not that there's anything wrong with that book. It's still a great program, and it's certainly succeeded for a lot of people. But there are better ways to do things now, or at least smoother ways to do things, especially for newer lifters. There's better stuff for advanced lifters to do. There's just more out there, and we haven't shared that. Yeah, we've put all this, you know, we put out all these other books, Abs, Life, Supercharged, and a lot of people who started with us after picking up New Rules for Women read those. But at the same time, every week there are still hundreds of people who pick up New Rules of Lifting for Women instead of all these other books we've done since then. So to me, we just left this it's like you walk out in the middle of a conversation without, you know, it's like, well, there's more to the story, but I'm sorry, I'm busy. You know, I got to end this here because I got to be somewhere. Mm-hmm. Well, 7-8 years later, I didn't have anywhere else to be. And I thought, okay, now let's sit down and let's finish this. Let's at least bring them up to readers up to where we are now, show them what Alan can do now. Show, if nothing else, here are some great workouts you can do after you've done these and after you've had success with these. Here's a great way to continue that progress and, you know, keep going. So you don't think, oh, I finished a 7-month program. What do I do now? Oh, I'll do it again. Okay, now it's, you know, another 7 months. What do I do now? Well, this is the answer to that question. It's either for the readers who came before, or hopefully for a lot of those new readers who, like I said, a couple hundred a week are still picking up the other book. If we could get some of them to pick up this new book, I think that, you know, the results, it certainly would be easier to grasp what to do, more options for what to do, more, and I think a smoother transition from that beginner status into the more confident, more experienced, more advanced lifter. So I feel like we're picking up a thread from 7-8 years ago, and now we're saying, okay, here's the rest of what we have.
Damn, that's a great way to finish it up. So let's just remind everyone, the book is called Strong. You know, if you just go to Amazon, type in Strong and Lou or Alan, you'll find it right at the top of your search box at Amazon.com or your local bookstore, you know, if you still have those kicking around. Now, I will say, if you are one of those people that really loves this show, and Amazon will literally kick like $1.25 to me if you buy this book through either like the link that I put on Twitter or in the show notes of this show, and you've wanted to support the show in the past and you just haven't been able to, or you want to pick up the book, and it doesn't hurt Lou, doesn't hurt Alan, it only hurts Amazon.com. So screw Amazon.
It doesn't even hurt them. I mean, there's a reason they call it a commission, right? A sales commission, because you've done the sale for them.
Right. So
you earn that money.
It's nice. So I think it's like, you know, 8% or whatever it is. But, you know, again, I would appreciate it. And like I said, even if you don't, I still go pick up the book. If you're a trainer in this industry, if you're someone that considers yourself a fitness enthusiast, if your headphones are on right now, if you're listening to this in the car or listen to it on your computer, this book's for you. And I think like on Amazon, it's like $19, I don't use the cup of coffee thing anymore, but seriously, who doesn't have $20, or who hasn't blown $20 on a crappy beer at a terrible club? That's my new one. Like $20 for like $11 for a Bud Light. Plus you have to tip the bartender. So it's like 1.5 Bud Lights at a terrible club that you didn't want to go to in the first place, or that your bachelor party is at or whatever. So
Kevin, you make me feel so good about being old that I can honestly say I don't have the crappy $11 beer at a crappy club.
Oh,
problem.
Man, it wasn't like 2 weeks ago. I was like, what, how much is it? $11 for a Bud Light? What's in this? Is it like the, it's like that, whatever that booze, the Goldschlager. It's like, is there a flecks of gold in my Bud Light now? But yeah, no, seriously, go pick it up. The programs from Alan Cosgrove are outstanding. And just the information that you're going to get from the first half, in terms of the information that Lou Schuler put together for you, from the nutrition stuff to just, you know, the research-based stuff is all great. It's stuff that, you know, I get so many books that show up at my doorstep, so many products in this fitness industry. And, I know you lose some, a low bias, but like, I'll be straight with you. If there's ever something that comes up in the book that like, man, I don't know about this, but you guys really hit a home run with this thing. And again, my only criticism is like, man, it should say for men, like just at the bottom, throw like a sticker on it. And for men, like after it hits like 400,000.
Well, I gotta say, Kevin, well, thank you so much for everything you said about the book and about my other books. But I feel that, you know, given the response to New Rules of Lifting for Women, I mean, the overwhelming response to that book, that I would say that audience really deserved another book of their own.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, you're right. No, you're totally right. And we need to help out. I think you also mentioned in the book, like the number one thing that our women are always getting told through media, through magazines, television, radio, podcasts, whatever, that they need to lose weight. You have to lose weight, lose weight, lose weight. You have to, you know, lose weight. So the message that you guys are putting out there in terms of getting stronger, and again, don't think you could have a better model on that cover than Jesse Nealand, who is just right. A strong, beautiful badass. And
right. And I should point out that that's just what she looks like. She didn't lose weight to, you know, to be on the cover of, you right. can, you can go to her Facebook page or
go to
her
Instagram
website.
Today. She looks like she does on the cover.
Right. And that's just what she looks like. I mean, she's fit, she's strong, she's wonderful. She has an incredible energy level. And that's, you know, that's a real woman. That's what she looks like. You know, nobody else looks like that. And that's okay. We're not all supposed to look the same.
Love it. All right. Well, check it out. It is strong. Don't forget to check out LouSchuler.com. Of course, at Lou Schuler on Twitter. You can find him on Facebook if you want to get some more advice on perfecting the bald head as we get towards the the winter seasons. I just ordered 3 new beanies for the winter season because you got to keep that head warm, man. You don't want to get sick.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And you got to rotate. You got to rotate them, right? Give them time to air out in between.
Hell yeah, man. That's why I bought a couple. And right? Like, we're going to be shoveling. Those things are going to get cold. You're going to have to throw them in the dryer to warm them up because they're going to, you know, get wet after being outside in the snow and it warms up. And I swear, like, this is one thing when I was a kid, my dad wouldn't let us leave the house unless we had a hat on in the winter. And I would fight him. I would just fight him on it all the time. And now if it's like under 63 or 62, you bet your ass I got a hat on. Like, I got a beanie on. I got my North Face lineup. I even tried some different brands this year, but I even wear them to bed. I'm ready to go. Got to keep that head warm. Don't want to get
that's sore. Hardcore.
It is. I like to keep it cool, but I don't like my head to be cold. So you got to, I wear a hat, and it's whole another episode. So
this has been a special follicle challenge episode of the FitCast.
Oh man. Yeah, no, totally. And it's not only that I just shaved my head now, like I've been growing out a little bit and I'm like, oh, my hair is actually thinning out a little bit. So I'm just going to go back to keep it pretty short. So don't worry if you're someone out there whose hair is thinning, it's all good. Just buy a beanie before it gets too cold. So, Lou, anything else that people should keep a heads up for? Anything that you have coming up or that you want people to know about?
Well, you know, anybody who's listened to this for all 1 hour and 10 minutes knows a lot more about me and my work than they probably ever wanted to know. I would just add, the book comes out November 10th, and I'm not sure when you're going to go live with this episode. But
days before release, like two or three days.
Right. It is never. OK, so good to know. So it's never too early. Make a pre-order. And in fact, yeah, pre-orders totally really help us in terms of the algorithms and in terms of where this will show up on search engines, where it'll show up on Amazon, how many promotions Amazon sends out to, you know, to its customers. So any purchase at any point really helps us. And of course, I hope ultimately it helps you, because that's the reason we do this. If it doesn't, you know, if it doesn't help you, there's no point. But I just want to say that the book comes out November 10th, but there's absolutely no impediment to ordering it before then or to ordering it after. Same price no matter what.
Yeah, and I will say, like, the reason why I do order, like, I just got the new Jurassic World Blu-ray from Amazon today. If you pre-order stuff there, they will give you the lowest price that it's at before it ships. So, like, they're always fluctuating their prices for, like, with their algorithms and stuff. So, like, they'll bump it up, like, $2 or $3, you know, either way. So if you do just get in like a pre-order right now, it might actually go down even more before it gets released, and then you'll actually get that cheaper price. So it is a great little setup that they have on there to convince us to all buy their, you know, buy the stuff that we want through them. So I guess they're not completely evil. At least they give me a good deal. Thanks, Amazon.
All right. Yeah, Amazon needs a hug, right?
Oh yeah, they're hurting. Jeff Bezos, man. Oof. I'm gonna send him a greeting card this holiday season with just a, you know, a hug and a little bit of my perfume on it. So,
well, and send him a beanie because, you know, he looks like the kind of guy who could use a little warmth.
Yeah, he is, man. He's stressful, dude. Stressed out, dude. All right. Well, don't forget to also check out the VicCast on iTunes. I really appreciate it. If you enjoy the show and you want to kick a buck or two to the production of each episode, you can go to patreon.com/theVicCast. There you also get the episodes 1 week early. Plus, if we do any extra content, that's going exclusively to you as a thank you for supporting the show and to helping me continue to do these shows as, believe it or not, just past this is 360. So that's a cool number. And then it'll be not so long until it's at episode 400. So hopefully that continues to go forward and you guys continue to support the show. I appreciate it so much. You don't know how much it means when I get those emails saying, you know, Joe Eastender donated or supports the show at $1 per episode. I don't know why I use that name, but Joe, thank you so much. And thank you, everyone who just downloads and listens. I appreciate it. It means a lot. And Lou, of course, thank you for taking the time to come on and talk about this awesome, awesome book that everyone needs to pick. I even bought a copy for my sister. I've never bought her a fitness book in my life. And I bought her this book because she sent me an email about, I won't mention what it is, but she sent me a question like, I heard about this. Like, is this a good thing to be doing for nutrition? I'm like, oh, I'm just going to buy you this book. Just wait. It'll be out November 10th. Go just wait. It'll be in your mailbox. Kevin. No, thank you for putting this stuff together. You guys are putting the hard work in and sharing the information. So that's where we'll leave it. Thank you so much, Lou Schuller. Thank you, everyone out there. We'll see you next time.